please the court. I'm Craig Morgan, representing appellants Mercury Marine and Sea Ray Corporation. As the court may recall, this is a product liability case arising out of a gruesome accident in which occasioned when four teenage boys were taking a Sea Ray ski boat manufactured by my clients out for an afternoon recreation on a lake outside of Austin. During the course of the afternoon, the boat was idling on the water while two of them were in the water waiting to be pulled on wakeboards when the rope came off the boat. The plaintiff, Jacob Brocktrop, jumped off the back of the boat apparently to retrieve the rope, and the operator of the boat, without looking to the rear, then put it in reverse and backed the boat on top of Mr. Brocktrop, forcing him under the water, severely lacerating his right leg so that it had to be amputated just below the crotch. The central problem with the way this case is tried and submitted to the jury is that it was tried on a mistaken impression of Texas law of product liability. And that is that throughout the case that the plaintiffs put on and the way the case was submitted to the jury in the charge reflected the perception that proving that there was an alternative design for the product, in this case the propeller stern drive, that would have prevented this accident was sufficient to establish a design defect, and that's simply not the law. There is a statute in Texas that requires the plaintiff in a design defect product liability case to prove what is called a safer alternative design, meeting a series of criteria such as would have prevented the accident, would not unduly impair the utility of the product, and was economically and technologically feasible at the time. That's just a requirement that is added to the common law obligation of the plaintiff to prove that the existing design of the product was unreasonably dangerous under the risk utility test.
Doesn't the charges contain the language in PJC 71.4A about the design defect being unreasonably dangerous? It may not do it in a question form, but it contains the language nonetheless.
It contains the language.
In defining what a design defect is, it says it must be unreasonably dangerous, just as the PJC and the statute say.
Well, the statute does not contain that language because
the PJC has that language, and it contains the very language.
The PJC, while not a model of clarity, actually is better than what was submitted here.
You didn't object to that particular part of the language, so at the charge conference, did you?
Oh, good Lord, yes.
Where is that? You objected about the definition of the safer alternative design, but where did you object to the definition of unreasonably dangerous during the charge conference? What page is that of the transcript? Maybe find it on rebuttal or something if it's difficult to find now, or tell me later.
We requested an instruction that would have told the jury that I can find that, and I believe it's in our brief, but during the charge conference, we requested the instructions that are contained in the record excerpts that would have made it clear that proving a safer alternative design is necessary but not sufficient to establish a design defect under Texas law. And the judge denied both of those requests. At that point,
But that was about the economic and technological feasibility.
No, Your Honor, that I believe you're mistaken about that.
Did you say that you need an actual question and answer about unreasonably dangerous rather than just an instruction about it?
At tab 7 on our record excerpts, there is a requested instruction that would have told the jury proof of a safer alternative design is necessary but not sufficient standing alone to establish a manufacturer's chosen design is defective. We submitted a similar instruction at tab 8. Both of those were denied.
Right, those are additional instructions.
Right.
But you didn't say that what was there about unreasonably dangerous wasn't good enough, did you? Did you object to that language about unreasonably dangerous?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. If you give me just a moment, I can find that. It's in our brief. We quoted the portion of the charge conference where Mercury Marines.
Design defect charge.
Pardon me?
Isn't the design defect charge that was given the pattern charge?
No, it's not. The pattern jury charge would have, my first response is that no, it's not. The pattern jury charge would have included the sentence that would have made it a little less ambiguous, that the proof of a safer alternative design is not sufficient to establish a design defect.
What sentence is it that is in the PJC that is not in this charge believe is seminal?
I don't have the PJC in front of me at this point, Your Honor, but the threshold point at any rate is that it's irrelevant what's in the pattern jury charge. The pattern jury charge is not the source of law in Texas. It has no legal authority in Texas, and I cited a whole series of cases in my brief demonstrating that fact, the most recent of which is the Ledesma decision, and a whole series of those. That is merely a guide. It is not a source of law. It does not carry authority. And if it's wrong, PJC has to be changed, not the law.
It is very difficult for a court of appeals in Texas to reverse a trial judge who followed the PJC, much less than a court sitting in some sort of eerie capacity to reverse what's in the PJC, isn't it, counsel?
Well, if I may, Your Honor, I will hold the PJC.
And the question.
Good thing Judge Rubin isn't here. He'd hold you in contempt for putting that briefcase on the table.
Oh.
Can I take it down?
And the important question before this court, at any rate, is whether this charge clearly instructed the jury on the necessary elements under Texas law. It's not whether the charge that was given can be construed consistent with Texas law. The requirement is that it clearly instruct the jury, and this charge did not. There is certainly substantial and ineradicable proof that there is certainly substantial and ineradicable doubt about whether this jury was correctly instructed on the law. Now, the sentence that I think would make the pattern jury charge a bit less ambiguous is the one that says, for a design defect to exist, there must have been a safer alternative design. That's left out of the charge this court gave. So if you look at the charge this jury received, it's told what a design defect is. And then the jury is given two things, and only two things, that the plaintiff has to prove. That a safer alternative design and producing cause. And at the charge conference, and I will find that, if I can find this, I can find the citation to that. It's cited in our brief. Mercury Marine's counsel presciently predicted that the ambiguity created by this charge was going to allow the jury to believe that the only thing the plaintiff had to prove to establish a design defect was a safer alternative design. There's no question that's not the law in Texas. The Hernandez versus Tokoi decision makes very clear that's not the law in Texas. However, the plaintiff's counsel then, in his closing argument, promptly got up and repeatedly told the jury, using the language of this charge, and I'll quote a few of these places in the closing, if there is a safer way to make a product, then it is unreasonably dangerous. The question as to whether it's unreasonably dangerous simply means, is there a safer design for it? These are all quotations from the closing, based on this language, based precisely on this language of this charge. Whether or not it's defective in a design defect context means, is it unreasonably dangerous because there is a safer way to make it? Going on. If there's a safer design, if there's a way to make that thing safer, then it's unreasonable for it to have been made the way it was, and that means it was a design defect, and on and on and on. Every single one of those arguments is legally wrong, but every single one of them was a reasonable inference from the charge as it was given. And there is simply no question under the Hernandez versus Tokoi decision of the Texas Supreme Court answering a question certified from this court that that's legally wrong. That the Texas Supreme Court in that decision said at least four separate times that proving a safer alternative design is required but is not sufficient. The plaintiff
Did the court define what unreasonably dangerous meant in this context?
Yes, it did. It lists, as are repeatedly done in Texas cases, it listed five factors to consider in the risk utility test. What they say is unreasonable, whether a product is unreasonably dangerous under the common law is determined by application of the risk utility test, which traditionally includes five factors. The very first of which is the utility of the product against the gravity and likelihood of the injury. The second is the availability of a substitute product meeting the same need that is not unsafe or unreasonably expensive. The third is the one that's now elevated to a requirement by statute, which is the ability of the manufacturer to eliminate the unsafe condition without impairing the usefulness of the product or significantly increasing its cost. The fourth is the obviousness of the danger or the presence of warnings. And the fifth are the expectations of the ordinary consumer. Those are the factors to be considered in the risk utility test.
But didn't the jury have to consider all that in definition of unreasonably dangerous in following the court's charge?
Well, the court's charge didn't give them any of those factors. The only thing the court's charge did was it said, you will find a design defect. But look at the charge. The question before this court on this jury charge really reduces to looking at this charge. Which is at tab 10. Putting this next to the Hernandez versus Tolkoy decision, which describes what Texas law requires a plaintiff to prove, and then applying the appropriate standard of review, which requires asking whether this charge clearly instructed the jurors as to the principles of the law applicable to the factual issues, and a reversal is appropriate if this charge as a whole creates substantial and ineradicable doubt.
But wasn't the definition of unreasonably dangerous part of the charge also?
No, it's not. Here's what the charge said. It's again a tab 10.
Why don't you just read to me when you...
All right. I'll read it. The question given to the jury was this.
You're talking about the interrogatory to the jury?
Yes, the jury charge.
I'm talking about the entire charge. The jury had to consider the entire charge when it answered the interrogatories. It couldn't just consider the question it took to the jury room with them.
Well, I don't believe there's anything in there that told them what to consider other than...
Well, you told me you gave a very detailed... definition of what they needed to consider to find the product unreasonably dangerous in the charge. Those four or five factors.
No, that's not in the charge.
Are we talking about two different things? I mean, when I say the charge, I mean the entire instruction that the judge gave the jury, not the verdict form.
No, this jury charge, the charge this judge gave the jury did not tell them to consider anything other than the existence of a safer alternative design. What I've just recited to the court is what Texas law says.
Didn't he charge him unreasonably dangerous? Wasn't that in the charge?
It's mentioned.
The design defect is a condition that renders a product unreasonably dangerous?
It's in there.
It's mentioned.
Well, it's in there.
He gave it.
It's in there. That's true. It is. My point is, the question isn't whether it is possible to read this charge consistent with Texas law. The question is whether this jury was clearly instructed on the principles of Texas law that require.
All right. What wasn't clear?
It wasn't clear that the jury that the plaintiff had to prove that in addition to the fact that there was a safer alternative design, that this product, as it was designed, was unreasonably dangerous, taking into account the risk of the product and its existing utility.
I thought that was in the charge. You just said it was.
It is not in the charge. What this charge says. It says there's a design defect is a condition of the product that renders it unreasonably dangerous as designed. It does not tell the jury that that's what they have to find. It says what they have to find is that to show a design defect, the plaintiff must prove by a preponderance of the evidence, and it lists only two things. There was a safer alternative design for the product, and the defect was a producing cause. It is easy, if not compelled, for the juror to believe that the only thing the plaintiff had to prove, which is in fact what the plaintiff argued to the jury, that the only thing he had to prove was that there was a safer alternative design for the product. And that is not the law in Texas.
And the defect was the producing cause.
Right. Producing cause.
Say only. He had to prove two things.
Well, two. Right. producing cause, well, there was never any dispute that this person's injury was a result of getting the leg into the propeller.
Mr. Morgan, tell me once again whether the judge, in giving his instruction to find unreasonably dangerous and the factors the jury had to consider and whether the product was unreasonably dangerous.
No, he did not tell the jury they had to find those factors.
What he
did
what?
Not tell the jury that the plaintiff had to prove any of those factors.
I'm asking you whether the judge, in defining unreasonably dangerous, laid out those factors for the jury.
I do not believe so, no.
He didn't do that in the charge.
No.
We won't find that in his
instruction. I do not believe so. And the jury was certainly not told the plaintiff had to prove the product was unreasonably
dangerous. I'm not asking you that. I'm asking you whether he defined that for the jury in the instruction.
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
So when it says at page 6, a design defect is a condition of the product that renders it unreasonably dangerous as designed, taking into consideration the utility of the product and the risk involved in its use, are you saying that's not in the charge that appears to be in the signed charge?
That's in the charge, but the point is the jury was not told they had that this was something the plaintiff had to prove. It is possible, this is the point, it is possible to read this charge in a way that's consistent with Texas law. It's just as easy to read this charge as the plaintiff argued it to the jury, which is that this is the way Texas defines
it. You have a red light, Mr. Morgan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You want to run on your rebuttal time?
No, that's all right.
All right. Mr. Alden?
May it please the Court, Your Honor. My name is Robert Alden. I am the attorney for Jacob Brocktrup. I represent him today proudly in this court, and I represent him proudly in three different trials. I have a little benefit that Mr. Morgan didn't have because I tried the case three times. Since the 1980s, the concept of putting a guard around propellers really came into existence. And since that period of time, despite having a $60 million a year research and development budget, $60 million a year, as Mr. Chisholm testified at trial, Mercury Marine has not spent one penny trying to develop a guard. And for the most part, they didn't have to, because since the late 1980s, the federal courts had held that products liability cases involving propeller strikes was preempted by the Fair Boating Act, which delegated to the Coast Guard the authority to regulate boating. In 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court took up that issue in the Spritzma case, and they said no. In no little part did the Supreme Court come to their decision, but they had help from the United States Coast Guard, which in fact filed an amicus brief on behalf of the injured person against Mercury Marine and Sea Ray, the very defendants in this case. Perhaps one of the reasons is because the Coast Guard uses guards on the propellers for their rescue boats when they're involved with, when people are in the water and are going to be near this very dangerous contraption. Now, I want to start, if the court will, with this question of the jury charge. And Judge Davis, you ask whether the factors were given by Judge Sparks in the definition of unreasonably dangerous. He did not do that. And the reason he didn't do it is because the Texas Supreme Court has very clearly instructed the courts that those definitional instructions are not to be given. And Mr. Morgan was wrong when he told the court that the pattern jury charge is not the law. I saw Judge Elrod had the pattern jury charge in front of you, and in a minute, if you want to, I can go through and I can compare Judge Sparks' charge to the pattern jury charge. It is almost verbatim the same. Now, federal courts...
The judge didn't define unreasonably dangerous.
Right, and here's why he didn't. Let me give you just a very little background. There's two component parts to a design defect charge. Part of it comes out of the common law, part of it comes out of the statute. The common law part was written by the Texas Supreme Court in the Turner versus General Motors case back in 1979. And in footnote 1 to that opinion, they wrote, do you find the question, and then they wrote the instruction, by the term defectively designed as used in this issue is meant a product that is unreasonably dangerous as designed, taking into consideration the utility of the product and the risk involved in its use. That is the very language that's still in the PJC to this day, and the reason it is because in 1984, in the Accord versus General Motors case, the Supreme Court wrote this, and, Your Honor, it directly answers your question, Judge Davis. It says, if Turner was not sufficiently specific, to advise the bench and bar that in strict liability cases, the jury is not to be instructed with balancing factors. Surely we have laid this matter to rest by our opinion in Fleischman versus Guadiano, which is a 1983 case, where we again endorsed the submission as approved by Turner and upheld the trial court's refusal to give any other instructions. The jury need not and should not be burdened with surplus instructions. And, Your Honor, Judge Elrod, Volume 3 of the Texas Pattern Jury Charge is 1982, which is still in effect today, straight out of the Turner opinion, except for the addition of the statutory language, utilizes for manufacturer design defect cases only the issue and instruction contained in Turner. We explicitly approve the pattern jury charges issue and instruction for design defect cases and disapprove the addition of any other instructions in such cases, however correctly they may state the law under Section 402A.
What are you citing right there?
Yes.
What are you citing, counsel?
I'm citing pages 115 through 116 of Accord, ACORD, versus General Motors Corp., 669 Southwest 2nd, 111. It's a Texas Supreme Court 1984 case. That case has been brought up and continues to be brought up and cited by the Texas Supreme Court, for example, in Ford Motor Company versus Miles, which is 967 Southwest 2nd, 377, a 1998 Texas Supreme Court case. They said, in accord, we approve the pattern jury charge issue and instruction for design defect cases and disapproved the addition of any other instructions in such cases, however correctly they may state the law. So I disagree with Mr. Morgan that the pattern jury charge isn't the law of the state of Texas. It very definitely is. The Texas Supreme Court has explicitly stated that they've adopted that. And, Your Honors, the charge that was given by Judge Sparks in this case was almost verbatim what is found in the Texas pattern jury charge. And I can go through line by line what he read to the jury and what's in the jury charge compared to what's in the pattern jury charge, and it is all there with one exception, and that's an exception of something that the defendant asked to be added over our objection. So the only thing that was added to the pattern jury charge was something that the defendants requested over our objection, and really we're not here arguing about it today. So as to the whole jury charge issue, Your Honor, I think that
But he says that the sentence that says for a design defect to exist, there must have been a safer alternative. He says that sentence left out. But right. I think doesn't he also argue, though, that that's the whole thing y'all argued to the jury as it was? So the one sentence is the point that he thinks that y'all made too much in lieu of the other point anyway.
Right. Yeah, and I would also.
Am I wrong? Or is there some other sentence?
There are a couple of questions you've asked. And I think that Judge Sparks did exactly, I disagree with what Ms. Morgan said, and I'll read what the judge said. I would also point out, though, before I do that, there were no objections made to my oral arguments. So if they thought that I was misstating the law in any part of my argument, they certainly could have objected to it. There were no objections. But on pages 170 and 171 of volume 20 of the record is where Judge Sparks is reading to the jury charge he gave to them. And going to your question, in the pattern jury charge, there's a sentence, the instructions which are straight out of the Turner case. It says a design defect is a condition of the product that renders it unreasonably dangerous as designed, taking into consideration the utility of the product and the risk involved in its use. Judge Sparks gave exactly that language beginning on line 18. And running through line 21 on page 170. The next sentence goes on to say, which is what Judge Elrod, you asked about, goes on to say, for a design defect to exist, there must have been a safer alternative design. And then the PJC goes on with the statutory language explaining what safer alternative design. Judge Sparks altered it only slightly. Judge Sparks likes to do that. And here's what he wrote. Instead of saying for a design defect to exist, there must have been a safer alternative design, he wrote, and it begins on page 25 of page 170, to show a design defect, the plaintiff must prove by preponderance of the evidence, one, there was a safer alternative design for the product. There's virtually no difference. The PJC says for a design defect to exist, there must have been a safer alternative design. Judge says to show a design defect, the plaintiffs must prove a safer alternative design.
He just didn't say preponderance of the evidence.
I'm sorry, what?
He left out preponderance of the evidence.
No, he said, the judge did say preponderance of the evidence.
Okay. He just said to show instead, and he combined it with to prove instead of saying that sentence. He put it in, go ahead.
Yeah, the PJC says for a design defect to exist, there must have been a safer alternative design. And Judge Sparks says to show a design defect, the plaintiffs must prove by preponderance of the evidence, one, there was a safer alternative design. And then number two, he goes on to say producing cause, which is also part of the PJC's. It's just not in the same one that that gives the instruction for design defect.
I mean, you think it'd be erroneous under the Texas Supreme Court case for the judge to have had his number one point, in other words, to show a design defect, the plaintiff must prove, number one, that the product was unreasonably dangerous in light of its utility and the risk involved in its use, and then number two, there was a safer alternative design, and number three, the defect was the cause?
Yes, Your Honor, that is exactly the issue that was taken up in the Accord case, and the Texas Supreme Court, that language that I read to you from the Accord case, the Texas Supreme Court addressed that directly when they said, we explicitly approve the pattern jury charge issue and instruction and disapprove the addition of any other instructions. And the ones they were talking about, well, they said before that, if Turner was not sufficiently specific to advise the bench and bar that in strict liability cases, the jury is not to be instructed with balancing factors. And that's exactly what the judge is asking about. So the courts have said, don't do that.
Well, he could have asked two questions. One, is there a design defect, and was there a safer? He could have done it the way the PJC in the multiple.
Well, the PJC only has one question.
But, I mean, he could have done it with to make it a little bit more plain about reasonably unreasonably dangerous.
Well, the PJC has only one question.
But it's kind of highlighted in a little, the way it's done, it's highlighted off about unreasonably dangerous a little bit more.
Well, where it talks about a design defect.
Right.
I think that's essentially the way the judge instructed the jury.
Well, I think the words are in there. It's just whether or not, it's not set off exactly the same, but.
It may not be set off exactly the same, but substantively, I don't think there's any difference in what he said. That whole first sentence where it says a design defect is a condition that renders it unreasonably dangerous, the judge gave that verbatim.
Can you address other folks have questions about the charge, can you address the sufficiency on the unreasonably dangerous?
Right. The factors that this court can certainly consider, and the courts do consider when they go through looking at these cases, the Hernandez versus Tokai case, which the petitioner has cited to the court, was one of those cases. It was a certified question from the Fifth Circuit to U.S. Supreme Court. They went through and they laid out each one of those five factors that determine whether or not it's unreasonably dangerous. Now, the starting point that I want to start with is a case that we cited in our brief, the Tempty case, in which the Texas Supreme Court recognized that in cases very much like ours, the issue of whether or not there is a safer alternative design oftentimes will be and is really the focus of the trial, and that was certainly the case in our case. There's no doubt that the issue of whether there's a safer alternative design was took up a vast amount of the time. Of course, when we're only given 10 hours a side, you can imagine how quickly you're trying to get through evidence. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that virtually isn't in dispute. Now, I'll go through those five factors with you very quickly, and I'll tell you where you can find evidence on each one of those. Item number one, the utility of the product to the user and the public. That's the first factor. That's part of the first factor. The utility of the product to the user and to the public. That wasn't in dispute. The utility of this boat, it was described by our witnesses, which included a man named Lee Weber, who was a private consumer. He was not an expert witness and testified about the usages of the boat. We also offered the 30B6 testimony from Mercury Marine's 30B6 designee, Mr. Richard Snyder. Mr. Snyder testified about how these boats are used. Mr. Chisholm, who they called in rebuttal and was their director of product safety after Mr. Snyder, testified. The utility of the boat's not an issue. That's not brought up. There was absolutely evidence about the utility of the boat. The next part of that factor says, weighed against the gravity and likelihood of injury from its use. The gravity of the danger in this case absolutely was not in dispute.
What about likelihood of injury?
Yeah. The big point that I think, in fact, I want to answer your question, but just a little skip ahead. If you look at all the rest of these factors, there's virtually none of them that are in dispute, and I don't think there's any of them that are brought up in the appellant's brief here. I think where they point out is this issue of whether or not likelihood is. Their position is that in order that we had that their position is almost that that's an element of our proof that we had to prove. And I disagree with that statement to begin with. These are only factors. The element is unreasonably dangerous. These factors are things you can consider. But there doesn't necessarily have to be proof by me or by them on all of these factors. They're simply factors they can weigh. But as to the likelihood of the injury, they have not cited a case that says that proof of likelihood of the injury means what they say it does, and that is you've got to prove the frequency of the accidents or the number of the accidents, or as they argued to Judge Sparks during their judgment for motion for judgment as a matter of law, that we had to provide some statistical information from an expert. There is no case that says that's what likelihood means. And there is no case, including the Hernandez versus Tokai case, where a child was playing with a cigarette lighter that was designed to use for an adult. There's not even any discussion by the Texas Supreme Court when they're advising the Fifth Circuit about what must be proved in a products liability case. There's no discussion even that the plaintiff has to offer some kind of evidence about how often these kinds of injuries would happen. I have no idea how many times disasters like what happened at Tokai happen, where a little child gets his hands on a cigarette lighter, it happens to burn somebody, another little friend, severely. But there wasn't any statistical information, there was no frequency, and the Texas Supreme Court didn't even mention it in advising the Fifth Circuit about what must be proved. What does the word likelihood mean? I would submit that at least one reasonable interpretation of what likelihood means is how likely is it that you're going to be injured and that it's going to be a grave injury if you somehow have the design defect affect you. And believe me, Your Honor, there was plenty of testimony, including from our biomechanic expert, Mr. Brian Benda, as well as their own biomechanic expert, Mr. Mike Scott, about the likelihood of injury. Mr. Scott, who ran tests on behalf of Mercury Marine, did not even subject his dummies to a propeller because he said, I don't need to do that. I know what's going to happen. It's going to destroy the dummy. What is the likelihood of being grievously injured by a propeller? If you come into contact with it, it is a virtual certainty. As Mr. Snyder, their 30B6 representative, testified when we read his testimony to the jury. In his words, there's no contest.
What about the utility? How was the boat handling affected by a prop, by a guard?
You can't imagine with three trials especially the amount of testing that was done by experts on these boats. And there was an incredible amount of testing. Both sides called witnesses to testify. We called a man named Lee Weber, who was just a consumer, who owned boats and had experience operating boats, but he was a layperson, to testify about how the boat handled. And we called a man named Bill Greenlees, who testified. They called their experts, Robert Taylor, who's made a living, as he testified to the jury, he's made a living for more than 25 years and billed millions of dollars to the boat industry to testify on their behalf. Here's the effect. Here's the bottom line. Our witnesses said it had no effect. There was no effect whatsoever to the utility of the boat. Mr. Snyder, their 30B6 designated representative, who had been the director of product development for Mercury Marine for more than 30 years until he had retired before this trial came up, and yet he was still their 30B6 designee. Mr. Snyder testified and I will tell you where you can find that on, in the record. Mr. Snyder testified on page 129 of volume 19 in response as we read it into the record that the guard did not affect the utility of that boat at all.
Well, he said without significantly affecting the utility, didn't he?
He said you could do everything with that boat with the guard on it that you could do without it. Here's the evidence that the Mercury, and you know, Your Honors, of course, here we are. It's a sufficiency of the evidence question. And so you're supposed to consider all the evidence in our favor. But if you want to consider the evidence that they offered and what they said, here's what they came up with through Mr. Chisholm and Mr. Robert Taylor, their paid expert. One is that the boat might have a tendency to roll. Under what circumstances? Only under testing circumstances where they violated their very own instructions on how the boat is to be handled. The boat had a tendency to roll only if you overloaded the boat with three grown men on one side of the boat, as opposed to the driver on the other, and you did not properly adjust the trim as you're supposed to, and you kept it fully trimmed under. Sir?
You have a red light.
I do. I apologize, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Morgan, back to you.
I'd like to very quickly address some of the court's questions. Our objection to that relevant portion of the charge is described in our opening brief on page 27, where it makes reference to the citation 20, transcript 160. I won't bother reading it to the court, but the Mercury Marines Council made it very clear that the instructions that the court was going to give the jury would permit that jury to believe that the only thing the plaintiff had to prove was a safer alternative design and a producing cause, and that that's not right. We wanted the jury, it made clear to the jury that they had to also prove that the existing design was unreasonably dangerous under the risk utility test, and it wasn't enough to prove there was a safer alternative
did
for it.
Did the judge give this to the jury on written interrogatories?
Yes. They're in our...
Are they in your record excerpt?
Yes. Okay. The relevant right. part is at tab 10. Give the court the precise page. It's at tab 6. It was the question that was given. The assertion of the pattern jury charge is a source of law is simply not accurate. Our reply brief on page 27 collects a whole series of cases confirming the pattern jury charge is not a source of law.
Unless the Supreme Court adopts it as approvingly.
Thought so. The Accord decision upon which they rely was in 1984. That was 9 years before the statute that's at issue here. The pattern jury charge that was in effect then is not the same one that's in effect now because the statute that was adopted to require proof of a safer alternative design did not go into effect until 1993, fully 9 years after the Accord decision. So the pattern jury charge that was in use and at issue in Accord was not the same one that's at issue now. It was even being used now. Furthermore, the Accord decision did not deal with the issue, had nothing to do with the issue here at all. What was at issue there were instructions that the defendant wanted presented that would list the factors that the jury was supposed to consider that were regarded as gratuitous, nudging, extraneous things. The jury's supposed to consider this and that and the other. And the court said that that's not necessary to tell the jury this whole list of factors to consider and tell them things like the existence of the accident doesn't prove the product is defective. It was that sort of instruction. It had nothing to do with the issue that's here, had nothing to do with the pattern jury charge being used here, and could not have considered the statute that now requires a safer alternative design because that wasn't even adopted until 9 years later. What we're dealing with, and by the way, we're not objecting. I tried to make this clear in our brief. We're not objecting to an improper jury argument. We're objecting to the jury charge that permitted an erroneous perception that allowed the jury to be misled, that encouraged the jury to be misled into believing that the only thing that the plaintiff had to prove was a safer alternative design and producing cause and not prove that the existing design of the product was unreasonably dangerous. Under the proper statute, at least for this issue, on the jury charge, I think the court's task is pretty straightforward. You take this charge, the instructions that were given to this jury, lay it down next to the Tokai decision, which repeatedly says over and over and over again, as if anyone could possibly miss the point, that proving a safer alternative design is necessary but not sufficient. It goes on and on and on. It says that four separate times. It describes the other things that have to be done to prove the product is unreasonably dangerous on the risk utility test, and it repeatedly emphasizes that proving there's a safer alternative design is not enough. And if it wasn't enough in that case, by the way, in which the defendant, manufacturer of this non-childproof cigarette lighter, essentially conceded, virtually stipulated that there was an alternative design that would have been safe for the child, then if it wasn't enough in that case, it's certainly not enough here. Now, and the question is whether this jury was correct, whether the instructions given to this jury clearly instructed them as to the principles of law applicable to the factual issues. Reversal is appropriate because the charge here, as a whole, does create substantial and ineradicable doubt whether the jury has been properly guided in its deliberations. And we objected precisely on this point, and we should be entitled to a new trial at the very least.
All right. Thank you very much. We have your case, gentlemen.